Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
When you golf in Missouri, the courses are so close, you'll spend more time on the fairway than the freeway. Reserve a tee time at the Regal Osage National, designed by the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Take a cart ride on the wild side in the breathtaking surrounds of Payne's Valley, designed by Tiger Woods. And after the back nine, there's still world-class dining and distilleries, shops and spas, museums and more. Find your new golf MO in Missouri. Start planning your golf getaway at visitmo.com.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Friends from Work, a podcast about all things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, hosted by me, Robbie Earle, and by my good longtime friend from work, Kyle Schoenwill. This is a special bonus episode. We normally just do our Thursday main reviews, but holy cow, there's so much going on, even just within Moon Knight, but also within the MCU in general, because Kyle, we are recording this on Saturday, but releasing it on Monday, which means when people are hearing this, we will be like 12 hours from seeing Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness.
Yeah, we say this all the time, but it's insane that it's kind of snuck up on us again.
Yeah.
I've been so in Moon Knight world that all of a sudden it hit me, oh my gosh, I'm seeing this in 12 hours. Like, what? Are you...
One is especially crazy because both of these projects are so wild and so, for me at least, immersive. Like, the Doctor Strange stuff, as we'll kind of talk about here in a second, has so many facets to it that we can predict and explore and wonder about. So I feel like it's really easy to just get in that mode. But then Moon Knight is just out here like blowing minds on a weekly basis. So it's like whenever I get ready for this episode and rewatch episode 5, it's like now I can't even think of Doctor Strange because of how wild Moon Knight is. It's a embarrassment of riches, I feel like, more than we've had. I think maybe actually more than we've had post Endgame or maybe ever in terms of like overlapping projects like this. I think it's a really special time for MCU fans for sure.
No doubt. Part of the reason we wanted to do today's episode is because of the timing of this film, we aren't going to get to do a spoiler-free preview episode because we're only seeing it a few days before you guys are, and we have the Moon Knight finale that has to come out and then the actual Doctor Strange episode as well. So we wanted to do a little bit extra today to help preview some of that, you know?
Well, and we've got some really fun creator conversations with some folks working behind the scenes on Moon Knight that I think y'all will really enjoy. So,
and we have a few leftovers from Moon Knight that, you know, leftovers that we didn't get the grace we were hoping to be extended, apparently. Yikes.
Right, come on.
I'm just kidding. So a few leftovers of that as well. So jam-packed episode, let's go.
Yes. So first off, a little bit of MCU news here. I mean, there's always MCU news on some level, but kind of a big story. On Friday, it was announced that John Watts is exiting the planned Fantastic Four film, which is big because I think that would have been big news 2 years ago with him having Homecoming and Far From Home under his belt. But post No Way Home, he's now one of the most successful directors of a film in cinematic history. True. So it's big news that he's exiting that.
Your 30-second reaction is?
So we should say there seems to be no drama, which is great. He basically just said he wants a little bit of a break from the superhero genre, which feels very fair, particularly after, I assume, No Way Home was quite the undertaking. Marvel said that they were sad to see him leave the project because they were excited about his vision, but that they understand that. and Kevin Feige said that he hopes to see him back for future projects. There have been alongside that leaks slash rumors slash, I don't know if we believe it or not, that he does intend to come back for a fourth Spider-Man film within the MCU. So that's kind of interesting given our conversation about, you know, whether this will be a whole new trilogy with a new director and a new take. That might not be the case if he comes back. So my reaction is, and then I'm curious to hear yours because we haven't really talked about this. And we'll talk about this more later whenever we have more time and there's less going on. I'm bummed because I really like John Watts. I was really excited to see him kind of bring the that like optimism that he brought, the kind of like interest in the early comics roots that he brought particularly to Homecoming, to the Fantastic Four. Like, I don't want to see a gritty version of the Fantastic Four that kind of modernizes it. I want to see something that kind of gets back to that Lee Kirby vision. And I think that John Watts would have been suited for that. That said, you know, I feel like Marvel will find a great director and somebody that can still accomplish that. So I'm not heartbroken, but it, you know, it is a bummer because I like what Watts does. What do you think?
I kind of have thoughts on both sides of it. On one hand, I think he made the greatest trilogy in MCU history. And I think he has a unique ability to write and shepherd and direct a story like he did with Spider-Man. And so I'm bummed that a person of that talent is not in the MCU right now. I was also interested to see, you know, what was he going to do with a different kind of story? Because we've talked about how he's been so unbelievable at bringing in the coming of age tale for Spider-Man. But I wanted to see what does the next step look like for Spider-Man. But in this case, a different kind of film in Fantastic Four. So like you said, bring that optimism, but can he transition into a more grown-up story? I think he can, but I was interested to see how he played that. On the other hand, you know, if he needs a break, he's earned it. My gosh, he's earned it. And I don't want a director to do a movie of this level half-heartedly or tired.
Right.
So in that case, definitely give him a break. And I do think there's a lot of other amazing directors out there that could also probably work on this. So I'm not panicked. That's my 30-second review.
I think, yeah, I think we're in a similar spot. Like I said, I think this will be a fun conversation to have. It's funny. We were talking on the Slack about kind of who folks would prefer. And some of those first names that we tossed out within that community, I'm now seeing all of the various like Twitter projections for, and some of those are rumors based and a lot of stuff that'll be kind of fun to get into. Some existing MCU directors that have expressed interest in Fantastic Four in the past. So that'll be fun. But like I said, we'll come back to that in probably a week or two once the Doctor Strange Moon Knight madness has died down. But speaking of Doctor Strange, and before we get to Moon Knight, we got a chance to get some messages from our listeners. We did a little last minute mailbag thing here because, like you said, Kyle, we are not going to have time to do the normal preview episode, which is the way the scheduling is working out, where the screening is. So we thought it'd be fun to kind of take one last chance to look at what y'all are wondering about and maybe make some final bold predictions here at the 11th hour. So we only have time for a couple here. So we're going to take two questions that I think are really great and cover a lot of the stuff that we heard. First up, we have a question from Warren. So let's play that real quick.
Hey, this is Warren. I'm just wondering, how far do we think they're going to go down the rabbit hole with Doctor Strange and all the multiverses? Or are we going to just be disappointed because we expect so much, and then we didn't get exactly like what we wanted, like Mephisto and whatnot. All right, that's it. Let's go.
So, P.S., shout out Warren. He is the guy on Slack that keeps Photoshopping my face on everybody. So, if you're wondering where my profile picture came from of me on the Hulk, it's Warren. If you're wondering why there's a guy that keeps complaining about CGI, it's Warren photoshopping my head on people. So thank you, Warren.
That's a great question, though. I think that we got into that a little bit a couple months ago when we talked about how so much of the hype was really built around the potential cameos and like legacy character appearances and all that. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm curious what your take is on this. Do you think that the multi, you know, there have been some interviews that I've seen come out even over the past couple of days, some featurettes from Feige and Sam Raimi talking about how they viewed this as an opportunity to let, you know, particularly Stephen Strange and Wanda Maximoff encounter other versions of themselves and sort of learn about themselves in that way. Do you think that this is going to be one of those like end game switcheroos where it's just like we're going to start off doing a lot of multiversal exploration, but there's actually like a whole nother side to this that we're not even really aware of? Or do you really think that this movie is going to just be like a long, like now we're in this universe, now we're in this universe, and then here's this character, and then now we have, you know, John Krasinski as Reed Richards or whatever? What are you, if you had to predict right now, where's your head at?
That second option, I think. I think that this is the first true multiversal movie they've made. Yes, Spider-Man deals with it a little bit, but that's not the point. Mm-hmm. And yes, Loki deals with it a little bit, but really not till the end. I think this is the movie that they're like, okay, we're doing it. Like we're doing all of it, I think. I don't think this is a red herring. I don't think this is a 30-minute multiverse, then we move on thing. I think they're going to look back and say this was like the launching pad for this next era. However, I also think that Sam Raimi and the Marvel team are going to somehow find a way to bring the movie back to the characters. Like, we're all talking mm-hmm. about the multiversal stuff, and I do think that will be the most it's ever been, but we're going to exit the theater thinking more about what happened with Strange and Wanda or whatever. I think, like, somehow they're going to rein it in that way, but it'll be the most extreme it's ever been. I know that's kind of general, right. But I do think they're going to go down the rabbit hole. Now, as far as the cameos go, I think they're going to be just that. They're going to be cameos. Like, I do think there will be some fun people that you'll see, but it's going to be like on that multiversal trip, not like Stephen Strange ends up in one multiverse and interacts with Logan, let's say, or John Krasinski or whatever. It's going to be more like, ah, I'm flying through it. Boom, boom, boom. John Krasinski, Logan, do, 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 boo, boo. You know, like that more than anything. I think.
Or like, yeah.
These are all guesses, obviously. And I just want to add that I'm not sure from a strictly artistic perspective that Sam Raimi would have taken a film that was strictly just craziness, like cameos.
Cameo City.
Like I don't know if that would be the movie he'd make his return to the superhero genre if that's what they had told him. Like, hey, make your movie, but you need to get this person and this person and this person and this person. You know what I mean? I don't think he'd be like, oh, dope. That sounds so much fun.
Yeah. No, I think that's fair. And I think I agree with you. One of the question marks for me still is exactly how significant the Illuminati will be. You know, we're reading up on that for the Comics Corner. And I do think it's going to be significant on some level, if not in this movie, but moving forward. But I'm curious, is that going to wind up being a council that's overseeing like all of this stuff, like the entire multiverse, and this is like a multiversal council he's meeting? Or is it like that's just one reality that they visit and that's the opportunity for him to meet this version of Professor X and maybe some version of Reed Richards that like could be operating in the same universe? I think I'm leaning more towards that, but I'm not totally sure. I do think it's fun. Somebody pointed this out. There was a TV spot that came out a couple days ago from Marvel that I won't get fully into because we're sort of in that strange territory where I think, like Annika, we're kind of close enough to the movie where some people don't want anything given away, even if it's being given away by Marvel themselves. So I won't go fully into that. It's nothing crazy. But one thing that was funny is it shows that Professor X is in his like yellow floaty wheel, not even wheelchair, like hover chair that looks, from the little glimpse we get, like the one that the Professor X in the 90s X-Men cartoon used. So, you know, of course, there's speculation that that's intentional, which could be the case, because if you remember, Kyle, when we interviewed Michael Waldron way back when and asked him what his history was with Marvel, what did he say?
Yeah, that 90s X-Men series. He did.
Yep. Yeah. So maybe that's just a little way for him to have fun. But yeah, either way, I think you're right. I think they're going to go down the rabbit hole in a lot of fun ways. But I think it's important for us to remember that it's ultimately going to be a story about these two characters, which leads perfectly into the other question that we're going to take up today that I'm actually very excited to get your response to. And that is from Trinity.
Hey, friends. This is Trinity. My question is primarily for Kyle, since he's president of the Wanda Maximoff fan club. But of course, I'd love for Robbie to weigh in as well. Is there anything you're worried Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness could do to change your mind about Wanda? Is there anything they could take too far that would put you off? And what are your hopes for Wanda going forward? Thank you.
All right, Kyle. So you're the president of the Wanda Maximoff fan club. So let's hear from you on that.
Really good question. I actually haven't thought of it very much from this perspective. And I kind of like changing my mindset for a second here. I think the answer is yes, there's absolutely some stuff they could do that would take Wanda too far. What that is, I'm still processing. My favorite part about Wanda right now is how all of her power currently and her calmness come from that inner pain. And I do think there's a danger that we focus so much on how cool she is that we lose the character of it. Like, I like Wanda the character more than I even like her the superhero. To me, the superhero is her embracing that stuff, and that's why I think it's so cool. So, yeah, I don't think they'll do this, but I do think it's possible that they could make her kind of a character of herself. You know what I mean? Like, we lose the core of what she's going through. Yeah, but I don't think that's going to happen in this movie, because I do think that there will be some family stuff and her kids that are driving some of her motivations here. What are my hopes is a really complicated question, because you and I have talked about this a lot. Like, again, that core of her being torn up about Vision and not having a family is what makes her such a special character. So in that way, I don't want her to like meet up with White Vision and figure things out and have him become the Vision she used to know. Like, I don't want that, but at the same time, I want that, right? Like, I kind of want her to have a happy ending, but I don't really want it to be that. I know that makes no sense, but it's a really weird spot with that character, because if they give her everything she wants, it might feel a little bit cheap.
Yeah. Well, it's also interesting with the kids, right? Because I know we've talked about this at some point. All the events of WandaVision take place across a couple weeks, right? Like 3 weeks or something.
Right. If that even.
And so it is interesting, like I'm curious to see what kind of relationship she has with Tommy and Billy and what that desire for them looks like. Like, is she wanting to, like, the version of Wanda that we now have, you know, do you think she's going to be in a spot where she's wanting to actually build out a family and like live with Tommy and Billy somewhere Westview-esque? Or do you think that this is something she's kind of like given up on, that she's then pulled back into once she like encounters versions of them on the multiverse? And if so, like, how, I guess that's a question I have for you. Do you view that as now kind of being a core part of her character, like her relationship with Tommy and Billy?
What a fascinating question. I love this discussion, mainly because I'm just thinking about it now. if they do find her kids, I could totally see that her being like, oh my gosh, like, those are my kids and I want to raise them. And part of me is like, it could be kind of cool to have a badass mom in the MCU that's super powerful and people are like in awe of, basically.
Right.
But on the other hand, I could also see her being at a point where she says, you know what? I tried that. It wasn't real. And I'm moving on. Mm. And she's single, no kids ever. You know, and I could see that too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why, like, I'm just saying, yeah. it's a fascinating spot to be. Can I add this? I want to add this. I don't think, from what I've seen in the trailers, I think they're handling it how I want to. Like the line of, you mess with the multiverse and you're viewed as a hero. I do it and I'm the villain. I don't think that sounds fair. That's the version I like. It's not like crazy rage, like Dark Phoenix out of control, but it's also like her pointing out the double standard in some of Strange's activity, which, by the way, is fair to point out, especially since Spider-Man No Way Home. And she's so powerful that Strange has to listen to what she's saying. You know, that's the vibe I like. Regarding her family, I could probably go either way, I think.
Yeah, I was so excited and encouraged on the Wanda front by this featurette that I sent you that Disney put out Friday as well, interviewing Kevin and Sam Raimi about how they are viewing the Wanda side of all this. And it's just exactly what I think you and I would have hoped for. I mean, we've talked about how this is the first movie that will really reference a Disney Plus show. And they were really talking about WandaVision being something that this is a sequel to in some ways for her character. Like, they talked about how that's something they're really exploring and really leaning into and not just hand waving. And so we got some extra clips. Like, we saw a clip of Wanda breaking the fourth wall and looking at the camera WandaVision style, which kind of gave me chills. We also got a little bit more of some of these conversations with her and Strange, most of which I think we've seen in various other TV spots, but I'm really liking the way that chemistry is shaping up. And that conversation that they're having in the trees that showed up in that very first trailer after Spider-Man, and he's talking about, you know, get you back on the lunchbox.
I like that line.
I do too. I love Michael Waldron's writing, and I really like the, like, because you're right. Like, what you said was so true. Like, Strange is, there's a lot of overlap, I think, between him and Wanda. I think he, you know, there's the pain is an old friend line from the first movie. Now, I don't think Strange has had to deal with nearly the amount of pain that Wanda has, which I think creates an interesting dynamic, because, like, Wanda's life has just been, like, tragedy after tragedy after tragedy. Strange really just had the one tragedy that kind of like derailed his own path. But I think that they both are characters that are willing to kind of bend or break the rules. And I just think it's going to make for such a fun duo, particularly because the creators seem really interested in giving care and attention to Wanda Maximoff, who is, I think, you know, to your point or points, one of the more fascinating characters that's been built in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
I think that's one of the things I'm most excited about is the power duo there. It's kind of like the way I got so giddy with Tony Stark and Doctor Strange. I'm really excited to see this dynamic. That's just straight up.
Yeah.
That's so good. I don't know if that answers Trinity's question super directly. I don't have like a very tangible prediction, but it is a fascinating spot to have a character right now. So, well, we'll find out in 12 hours if you're hearing this. Maybe if you're hearing this, we found out already.
I think it's fair to, I think you answered the question in that I think if they move too far away from the story that WandaVision kind of pulled together so well of her life, I think you would be disappointed.
Right, but I don't think they will. That's the double answer there.
Same, sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, well, thank y'all so much for submitting those messages on such short notice. That's always really fun for us to get to hear from y'all. And what we also enjoy doing that I think we'll actually have the time to do this time around is some follow-up mailbag stuff once everyone's seen it, maybe kind of between a first and second viewing. So we'll probably be doing one of those here in the coming weeks as well. So if you didn't get a question in today, no worries. You'll have another opportunity.
So, Robbie, before we jumped back into Moon Knight episode 5 here, I wanted to prepare myself better. I went back and watched episode 4 and 5 again. And
wow, overachiever.
Overachiever, but I wanted to be ready. One of the things I really kept an eye on this time was the cinematography specifically. And we got a chance to talk with one of the cinematographers from this show, Gregory Middleton. And you're going to love this conversation. But he said something about how cinematography is really just trying to capture the story through the lens of the camera. And so that can sometimes be epic, big scale shots like on location, but it's also sometimes little camera work things they do that he works with the director on. And I was watching those two episodes really with that in mind, and it was such a pleasure. They do so many cool, even just different angles and different cuts that they had to do to differentiate Mark and Steven. And when he's going on that trip in the asylum, there's a lot of little camera work things that were so cool to separate those things out, as well as some of the epic shots in Jordan and the one inside the chamber of the gods. And it was really fun for us to chat with Gregory Middleton. You're going to like this conversation. It's only like 7 minutes long, but in those 7 minutes, he gave some really cool insight into some of the thought behind the camera work in Moon Knight. So without further ado, please welcome Gregory Middleton. All right, Gregory Middleton, welcome to Friends from Work. Let's go.
Thank you very much. Thanks, guys. Nice to be here. Thanks for talking to us about our craft and our show.
Oh, man, we're so excited. I was curious, you know, looking through, you have a very impressive resume, Gregory. You've worked on Game of Thrones. You've worked on Watchmen. And just for our listeners, one, what is it like for you to kind of prepare for a project? Like when you find out that you're going to be working as a cinematographer on a particular project, do you have a particular process? And two, did you find that there was a way that you prepared when you found that you were going to be working on Moon Knight specifically?
I'll try and I tend to answer long, so I'll try and keep it quick. I kind of started in kind of like, for lack of a word, like art house, small, strange cinema. Like the first film I shot was called Kissed, about a female necrophile. So, and that's a very unusual film and a very unusual story, which had to have a filmmaking thing that would work to tell it in a unique way. And that's kind of in the end what you sort of do with everything. It just that what you do is you learn techniques along the way and you get wiser about the kinds of decisions, but the sort of approach is similar. What was exciting about Moon Knight was the characters, the story is driven by the character. And, you know, Jeremy with these amazing scripts where like episode one is a horror movie from Steven's point of view, he's being haunted. And so you have this, like, you were going to disorient the audience like Steven. And then, you know, it'd be different genres as the episode goes on, and Mark would be one way. And that's a way where we can actually use the filmmaking, not just the lighting and the camera work exactly, but like all the filmmaking tools to uniquely tell a story in a way, which makes it, I think, more memorable and, you know, more of a impactful experience. And that's what excited me about the show. It was like, one, it's about people and understanding people, really. And it's an amazing story about, like, you know, reconciliation and healing within a, you know, fractured person.
From what I understand, you guys got a chance to film a lot of this on location or different locations. What locations were there, and what are the advantages of shooting some of that stuff outside of a studio set?
So I think one of the most amazing places I've ever shot is like the first scene after the titles in 3 is Harrow, and he's about to find Ahmet's tomb. And we're in Jordan, in a place called Wadi Rum, which is outside of Aqaba. It's a similar desert they used for The Martian. It's used a lot. It's an incredibly beautiful place, and it's not so far away to get to. And you know, the shot is like a kind of an ode to like a Spielberg or, you know, David Lean style thing where we're the camera's not moving very much. You can see the landscape. You know, it's very important if you want to see the landscape not to move the camera too much. You don't want to blur it. And then we stage the scene of the people slowly coming up and then reveal Harrow in the foreground with the scarab, which is kind of like a Spielberg shot. Like if you think of Raiders at the beginning and finding the you know, the dart and the tree, that sort of idea was the, you know, kind of what I was inspired by. I was going to show Muhammad and we plan a lot, but that's like an incredible place. I mean, how do you not point the camera at that as much as possible and stage everything in a way to see all that and then wrap around and do it in one shot? And if you know, Muhammad loved to try and do as much as possible fewer cuts, because it would lets the audience kind of the experience of discovering what's going on. We'd be very particular about trying to include things in the frame, not like cut to something if we had to, you know, have the thing in the shot, let the audience look at it. And if you're in that location, you want to not cut. You want to see all of that. Yeah. You don't want to see a cut to a hand. You know what I mean? It's like, you want to do all that. And that's one of the most amazing places I've ever shot.
One of our favorite set pieces from episode 3 was that tomb where they go in with all the gods and they have the avatar.
Yeah, like Oh yeah. Inside the chamber of the gods and the Great Pyramid. Oh yeah. That's, and we had an incredible production designer in art department. Stefania Sella is an incredible designer. And that was one of these things where a set that's that iconic, both it'll borrow from some things in various runs of the comics. And also, you know, Marvel being, you know, the company they are, like the heads of the company, I mean, they are the experts in everything of all their properties. So they do participate, you know, quite closely in the design of like character costumes and things like that. So it's kind of cool. And then one of the things that I find, which I got so lucky on, let's say even on Game of Thrones, is with really good concept art and a finely done process to sort of figure out what it is, that can generate great ideas for me. Cause I'm looking at each iteration of design, like, okay, so maybe if the statues are black, then I want to light the black statues with bluer light and the fire just to create some more, you know what I mean? You start doing things like that. And that's a process. It takes a while to sort of do all that. That was an incredibly huge set. It was a very tight shoot to do with a lot of material in there. But it's also an amazing scene. And like in the end, it's firelight and a lot of complicated things. And one of these weird things you do in large sets where I have to imply the set's bigger than it is. Like it's only built up to about 25, 30 feet above their heads, but it's supposed to be enormous. So I have to make the light sort of feel like it's coming from far away and not like as a light bulb at the edge of the frame. So there's a lot of technical things like that, which experience help with. But
yeah, you pulled it off. It looks amazing. Feels authentic.
Well, and I was going to actually, you sort of got to my question or my next question too with the comics inspiration, because I noticed, having read the Jeff Lemire and Greg Smallwood run, you know, there's a shot sort of later in that run that is super, super similar to that shot in episode 1 of the elevator opening and kind of the dark hallway.
Yeah.
And I mean, I assume that wasn't a coincidence.
It's actually that's interesting because I'd kind of forgotten about that image in that run also because it's about like a different type of set, but it was the bigger thing was to make it like he opens the door and it's black. And then to see him in this little light white, it's like, he is like, I'm sorry, there's no hope of figuring this out, dude. It's like, or just want to make it like, and that's like to see this little tiny window and all this blackness is like, it's terrifying after what we've seen so far. And it was more just using darkness as a point of fear. And what you hide is as important as what you show. You know what I mean? Like that's that kind of thing. But I actually don't know if we have remembered that shot. I don't think we did it consciously because of that. It was more just wanted it to be just, you know, when he got up there, it was like, I'm sorry, there's nothing there. You know, you're terrified. Now we're going to terrify you further.
That's even cooler because you kind of came to similar images totally separate.
Yeah. Well, I think because they're kind of trying to say the same thing in both mediums, right? Like it's trying to say it's the similar thing in a different environment in the comic. And that's where the interesting thing about, you know, visual art of any kind and adapting that into or using elements of it in this, like we did try and consciously do a few things. There are some poses with Moon Knight and like the iconic kind of like curved you know, moon cape when he jumps, and you want to try and bring some things in like that, and you know, the reflections and the like that, you know, hinted at and use parts of it, but it's not, you're not trying to copy it or trying to copy and post because it's a different medium. But it can also be a wonderful thing to borrow from those things and to include things. And if you know both pieces of art, I mean, Watchmen was a very similar sort of thing. We put some direct things in there especially, but it was more just for the people that wanted to see it. It didn't dominate and take over the composition or something, or it didn't make you think of something else other than the story. You want the story to be paramount.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense.
Gregory, thanks so much for your time. We can't wait to see what you do in episodes 5 and 6. Let's go.
I think you'll let 5 is a, I'm proud of 5. It's going to be quite a journey, I think.
Ooh,
enjoy it.
Very excited.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You know, it's so funny. We recorded this a couple days before episode 5 came out. And, you know, he made that comment about how episode 5 was, you know, the one that he was really proud of. And I get why now on the other side of it, as we're about to talk about episode 5 a little bit in more depth. Yeah, I mean, the camera work on that, especially on this last rewatch, is really extraordinary. I mean, what a fun opportunity for him that had to be.
No doubt.
Okay, another reason we wanted to do this episode is not only hearing from Gregory, and not only that you're going to hear from Hisham in a minute, who's the composer of this unbelievable score for Moon Knight that we've talked about so much. So that's really fun. Let's go.
I don't have a perfect pitch like you do.
I need to get some of those choirs on standby for me. I need those choirs to like be ready to record when I need them.
Just in your life.
I want it so bad. Just in general.
Like Conchu. Like, well, I meant mainly for music recording.
I meant mainly for music recording, not just as I walked into a room, but that would be convenient.
What a power move.
And now announcing
Kyle.
I love it so much, but I also have some leftovers. Remember we used to do leftovers on these movies?
Yeah.
We would talk for 2 hours and then still have so much to say that we'd have to come back for leftovers.
Yep.
We're doing that again. I wanted to follow up on a few things since we did our last episode.
Yeah.
So everything we said in the last episode still applies, still stands. It's unbelievable. I'm loving this show. Oscar Isaac is incredible. I mean, dude, Arthur Harrow is becoming one of the best villains in the MCU. It's just a fact at this point. The way they're portraying him, such a unique character, such a good performance, so weirdly dark and charming at the same time.
Dude, it's like the scenes in episode 5, like he is so comforting weirdly in that role with Mark, where it's like,
I know, he's so good at it.
It's so good.
Be gentle with him.
Like there are just a couple where he's like, he's talking about, oh, you know, you might visualize, and he says like, oh, so like maybe a psych ward. And I was just, I really zoned in on the way that Ethan Hawke responds there. And it's like, it could be a psych ward. Just in a very
right. Yes.
What was the
animal again? Rhinoceros? Oh, hippopotamus. Yes, it was a hippopotamus. I'm sorry. That's my fault. It was a hippopotamus.
And it's like
the way he's even talking like that. It's like,
he's playing a therapist
like very, very well.
Yes.
Like a psychotherapist.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. And in a way that is in line with what we've talked about liking about Harrow in the past, but also tweaked to really fit into that therapist role. And like the costume design there, just like the way they have him looking, his posture, it's just really, really, really nice.
How about the little detail of he spills a tiny bit of coffee on his lip and he goes, oh, I'm sorry. And like pulls out a napkin, like gently dabs it. It's stuff like that where it's like, what, who is this guy? And it's very, very good. So like I said, all that still applies. Another thing that really applies is, and I'm just saying these first, cause these aren't leftovers. These are reiterations. Holy cow. It's so troubling to watch. It's hard for me to get through the ending of that episode. The mom, and credit to her, she's playing it terrifyingly well. But it's really disturbing. It's not just sad, it's disturbing.
Yeah.
And it allows for an unbelievable performance from Oscar Isaac. Mm-hmm. Not just the street scene, just like the way he plays Steven, realizing all of that, just like watching, he's not even doing anything. His face is so heartbroken. He's not even saying a word. Like when he's watching the kid, but then the way he's playing the difference of Steven watching the kid and Mark watching the kid.
Yeah.
Like Mark's got a guilty look on his face while he's watching. Steven's realizing this and he's heartbroken and they're not even interacting with the scene itself. It's just,
it's
magnificent. It's honestly, again, another parallel. It's like why I fell in love with Elizabeth Olsen's performance in WandaVision. Cause you just feel the grief with these facial expressions. And I'm not sure that we've had too many people do that as well thus far.
Man.
So all those things still apply. I'm not going to go over all of it again, but it's fresh in my mind today.
Just from like maybe to cover all that. Well, actually two things from what you were just saying. One, I think like execution wise, just across the board without me kind of going through each part of this, I think this might be the best single Disney Plus episode that Marvel has put out.
You want to know a huge positive for this show? It's becoming like WandaVision, where I don't have a hard time recommending it to non-MCU fans.
Yeah, exactly.
That's high praise. Like my father-in-law is in town right now as we speak, who is not an MCU guy, but he's the guy that really liked WandaVision. And it's not hard for me at all to say to him, you should watch Moon Knight. And he's enjoying it and he is watching it. And like my neighbor, who's not like the most outspoken MCU fan, is watching Moon Knight. That's the difference, I think, a little bit between those two shows and something like Falcon Winter Soldier or Hawkeye, for example.
Right. Well, and like the lack of connectivity with this is even easier, I think, in some ways to recommend.
For that audience, for sure.
But also,
they really don't have to have seen anything to watch the show at all, pretty much.
And I'm reminded now that we're almost to the end of this series, how much was made of Oscar Isaac being creatively involved at kind of every level. Like, I think we had talked about that early on, how he really was shepherding this himself. And that also gives me a lot of faith in him creatively, to the degree that's true. I'm not trying to take credit from anybody else, because I know it's obviously a team effort. And Jeremy Slater and Mohamed Diab did, I'm sure, a ton of that as well. But I do think, the same way that we've had other actors really choose to inhabit that role, and I think that's always led to really successful storytelling, because when there's an alignment there, I think you can feel it within the audience. Like, I think you can feel the moment that Chris Hemsworth takes ownership of the Thor character. You can feel the moment Robert Downey Jr. does that, and that it's the very first moment you ever see.
It's the first thing, true.
And that stuff really, I think that's the stuff that sets apart certain characters. So it just makes me really excited. The other thing I was going to say there, when you were talking about Harrow, it maybe dovetails with this, which is I'm fascinated to see whether this is a Loki situation, where this is a season one.
Yep, that's what I was going to say. Just in general, as you were speaking about, I love Oscar Isaac shepherding this character, I have no idea what's going to happen on Wednesday.
Right.
This could be the end. This could be the end until we see him in a team up, or this could be just season one of season two, and they could do any of those things, and I have no idea. No idea.
Right.
Maybe four seasons. I don't know.
And one side of that would excite me is if that means we get more of Ethan Hawke, right? Like, I think I'm getting to a point now where I would be a little bit bummed to see him go, in part because, I mean, we talked about this with how much they have to wrap up and how some people are concerned. I don't know that I'm concerned because there are too many dangling threads. I think if anything, I would be concerned in that I've grown to love that character and that villain. And I think there are just some interesting dynamics that I think I would like to sit with a bit longer if possible. Now, I think there's still a world in which they could really, you know, land the plane very well. But yeah, I'd be a happy camper if we got to explore this a little longer.
So those were all reiterations of things we had said last week. Here are my few leftovers.
Yeah.
On the episode on Thursday, I gave a take about how I do think Jake or some other third personality is still out there and is still going to be revealed in next week's episode. However, on that take, I was 50-50 on it. I don't know that for sure. Mm-hmm. But since that first viewing of this episode, I went back and did some more research. I made a TikTok video, by the way, at the FFW podcast, if you want to see it, kind of putting that take out there. And I think 2 days pre the finale, I am now like 90% sure there is a third personality.
Wow.
So let me give you a few reasons why my mind is more settled on this decision. And again, I could be wrong, and we'll find out Wednesday, and I'll look like an idiot. Okay. There are multiple times in episodes 1 through 3 where neither Mark or Steven truly know what is going on. Something happens, whether he stabs somebody or he blacks out, and he does not know who actually did it. Neither person. I think that's a hint that there is a third personality that's doing things that is a little more out of control than the other two, and they're not aware of his presence. Secondly, I go all the way back to the first episode and the missed date.
Ooh, yeah.
Steven didn't know about that date, but Mark at the time is still clearly feeling for Layla, and I don't think Mark would have been hitting on another girl. It's possible, but we've been given no indication that would be happening.
Yeah.
So is it possible that Jake asked this girl out? and neither of them remember it. Third, I brought this up on the TikTok video. Obviously, we see a very focused in on third sarcophagus in episode four. And it's clearly shaking just like Stevens was when he let him out. Now, this one's vertical. It's not laying down. I don't know if that has some symbolic meaning. And there's a little bit of writing on the door. And I was trying to pause it and see if you could zoom in on that writing and see, does it say like Jake's room or, you know, whatever. And I couldn't make anything out. But I do think that that was so intentional. They zoom in on it. They hint at it. It's one of those things where in the chaos of it all, if you weren't looking for a third personality, you may just say, oh, that's some past memory or whatever and gloss over it. But since we're looking for it, I think that's one of those things that you'll go back and go, aha, that was another hint.
Yeah.
Then the big kicker, the scene at the beginning of episode five. When he comes back to the therapy session with Harrow, first of all, he has a bandage on his nose. We've never seen Mark get a cut or broken nose anywhere.
Uh-huh.
And this guy is beat up and has a bandage. Secondly, when he freaks out, his eyes click into something different. His facial expression is not Steven, it's not Mark. Go back and watch it. Here's the scene I'm talking about.
What I find extremely interesting is this new, the new animal character.
Hippopotamus.
I find that really interesting. This hippo could break down the walls between you and Steven and we might finally understand.
Understand what?
Well, before you got upset, you were talking to me about a boy. Do you remember that boy? Mm-hmm. You think you could tell me about that little boy?
Hey, thank you.
I feel really great.
I mean, they must pay you a lot of money in this place. You're really good. I tell you what, I feel like $1 million. Never felt so good. I'm going to see myself out. Thank you. Doctor,
I don't want to lose the big work we did today.
No, listen, Mark, be gentle with him. Be gentle with him. Listen, I am not your enemy.
That accent that you just heard is not Mark. I am 100% certain of that.
Right.
Mark is from Chicago. We saw that in his room and with the Cubs hat. He's not from the Northeast. That's a Northeastern accent, whether it's Boston, New York, etc. That's not his accent. Also, that's not the way Mark carries himself. That's not the confidence Mark has in those situations. Fourthly, or whatever number I'm on, I'm going to stop numbering them because I forget. He is doing it to kind of protect the moment when Harrow is finally getting somewhere about the little boy.
Huh.
That's the thing that triggers him as he says, you were telling me about a little boy. Can you take me back there? And that's when he says, you know what? I'm good.
Yeah.
It seems like Jake is a protector personality of both of them. That when there's so much pain or they're in trouble, they go dark and they don't even remember this, but this other guy takes over. And fifthly, or whatever, he grabs a weapon. Mark has not done this. Mark has been sedated. He's tried to run away, but we've never seen Mark like violently grab a weapon to either smash his own brains or smash Harold's brains with this diamond whatever.
Well, it does seem like he's trying to stab himself in that scene.
Yes, yes. Then that's the obvious stuff. There's other little hints that I could get into here that I don't think are as important, but like you brought up, we've never seen Mark panic like that when he hits himself.
Uh-huh.
That's possible. Oh, and I forgot one more obvious thing. The second Mark snaps into this third personality and changes accents, what happens? The second he kind of looks at him, Harrow pushes the buzzer for help. Like, Harrow's seen it before.
Oh, interesting.
Go back and watch how quickly he starts ringing for the wardens to come in. He goes, you know what, Doc? I'm good. I'm going to show myself out. And then like, come help immediately. I think Harrow knows that's that other guy.
I also noticed this time, you know, you talk about the bandage on his nose. When he comes back after that second time, when we get the explanation of the duod and it's Mark and Steven exploring past memories, and then it comes back, he doesn't have the bandage on his nose. And
right.
He's like, wait, Doc, didn't you inject me with something? And he's like, no, of course not. You know, I would never, we can't do that. So it's like, this is a different person slash scenario than the one that we had left.
Yep. So you know, that's my hypothesis. That's my hypothesis. Well, I have not put myself out there like this on this show very often, but I am doing it, and we're going to find out on Wednesday.
I have a question for you on that front, that this is something that I flagged on the first watch and thought maybe I just kind of misunderstood the scene, but then we had a couple of people write in with similar questions. And some people, I think, used this as evidence of the Jake hypothesis that you have forming there. In the scene where we kind of find out where and how and why Steven was created, I was watching that and I was a little confused because Steven comes out right as the mom's about to break in and beat him, essentially. And then Mark ushers Steven out. He's like, no, you're not supposed to see this. You don't have to see this. That's the whole point of you. And then they have the whole conversation about, like, you've gotten to have this happy, simple, normal life. But that is Steven that he swaps into as the mom's coming in there. So
right, so Steven like should remember people, it.
Right, exactly. So some people said, okay, well, maybe that's where Jake pops up. Like, actually, but I think that would be like a really strange thing to show, okay, he creates Steven and then Steven, like within that, immediately swaps over to a third personality. Like, I'm not saying it's impossible, but that feels like a lot to kind of shoehorn into that scene. So then I started thinking, is that a point at which Steven, like, does Steven just not see reality? Like, when correct, he's in that moment, is he just experiencing something that's totally fabricated?
That's what I think. I think it's okay. He almost goes into this shell that Steven wouldn't even remember the abuse. Steven's not a full real person. Keep that in mind. It's just a persona of right, Mark. Yeah, I think it's more that when he goes into that mindset, like, Steven is not out to lunch, but you know what I'm saying? Steven is not cognizant of what's happening. Hence, the adult version, not even like understanding that his mom died or like where he's located. For example, how does he call his mom and who's he hearing on the other end of the line? Because he's answering things. He's like, yeah, it happened again. As if like the person on the other line is saying something, but we know his mom is dead now. So I think it's just like a intentionally, I'm going to say something, I'm not trying to be controversial. It's almost like Steven is kind of like had a lobotomy, like in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, where he just doesn't even process what's going on at those points.
Right. Like a blocking.
Yeah, like a blocking, or like it's been intentionally removed from him to not have to feel the pain. Hence his like simple life, like using the word simple life.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's actually one of the other things I really liked being able to catch on this last watch was not just we talked a lot about kind of the emotional significance of some of these moments, but also the kind of plot significance of the moment in the street when Mark breaks down and he tells Steven, this is when our lives merged.
Right. And by the way, I caught that was only 2 months ago. Did you catch that this time?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that kind of tracks with what Mark told Layla, I think in episode 2.
When I had it under control until recently.
Right. Yeah. For what it's worth. And so that's interesting to me because then I'm thinking like, so prior, this is my read on this. I think prior to that moment, Mark was more or less like living his life and maybe just like particular at times Steven was coming out. I mean, we don't know how long, I don't think someone fact check me how long Steven's been at the museum. So that can maybe alter this read. But then I think at that moment, whenever he couldn't go in to his mother Shiva, and it was just like all of the pain, I think, bubbled up. He taught, like, there's a line where he's like, I just couldn't come to terms with it. Like, it was too much. And I think at that moment, does Mark then say, okay, look, I don't like being around for any of this. I can't really handle any of it. So Steven, you basically just get to have the body now. You're going to live the life. I'm only going to come in to be Moon Knight. So at night, I'm going to go out. I'm going to do what Khonshu tells me to do up until he basically is satisfied and Layla's not in danger and I've kind of met my obligations. And then you can just have the body, be Stephen Grant the rest of your life. I don't have any interest in being around for any of this. Is that sort of how you're reading
yes.
that?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
I think so.
Wow.
I think that's really smart and perceptive of you.
Man, what a wild.
So a couple more here. On the scales balancing front,
mm-hmm.
It's really interesting that the scales don't ultimately balance. It's weird. They slow down as they're making progress, working through this pain and communicating. Again, remembering this is the same person communicating with himself.
Right.
I think I'm right that Steven's gone. Because the scales don't totally balance until Steven dies. And I think it's that like emotional, like moving on thing.
Wow.
Again, I don't know how that sits with my Jake theory then though, because if Jake is still out there, why is there still not chaos in him from Jake?
Yeah, that's a good question.
You know, because like you would think that even if Steven went away, Jake clearly is also a problem at times and could cause the scales to not be balanced. So I know that's counterproductive to everything I just said, but I just thought it was unique. Like I really noticed the scales this time. They were balancing as they were getting better, but they didn't totally stop until Steven died. Even when they finally like came together and like made amends on that street, the scales were still not good enough, hence them being cast off or whatever. Until
right.
just Steven was cast off, you know? And it's because we found out that Mark is the host. Steven's the one that's quote-unquote, you know what I mean, not real. Not
right.
No offense to Steven.
Not the original.
Yeah. So that's going to have to be resolved with the Jake thing, I think.
Yeah. That's a really good question. And it kind of goes back to what this finale is going to be doing. Because if this is a season one, there's a world in which, you know, Jake is the kind of, you know, Kang's Taken Over style mm-hmm. cliffhanger.
Where post-credit he shows up stinger or something.
Right, right. And now it's like, oh, well, now we're going to have to see, like, what the Mark Jake thing looks like in season two. Or, mm-hmm. you know, yeah, maybe that's an earlier, like, we kind of get the explanation and then is it reintegrated like we were thinking where we get the comics version of we've got Jake, Steven, and Mark all operating in one? Or yeah, maybe you're right.
Or does Mark kind of move on and it never was Jake and they say that was just a violent version of Mark, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, I think what's so weird about that is we were so focused on the clues from the last episode because of the sarcophagus shaking in the episode before that. But I'm glad that you went back to that moment in episode three, because like we said, like on the previously on for episode four, they show that clip you were talking about where it's like, who was that? It wasn't me. Like, so they clearly wanted to bring that back to us. I think that paired with the sarcophagus feels significant for what they were trying to show us in episode four. And then that moment being so abrasive and so like that, what you're talking about with him grabbing the glass, like that felt like a moment that they were really calling our attention to. Mm-hmm. So I think that it would be really strange to have done that and then totally drop it. Mm-hmm. My only thought would be like the only way that I think that if it's not Jake, that they can maybe solve that would be if it is Khonshu, like we kind of originally talked about. Like if it's some way that like right. that's Khonshu controlling directly.
Yeah, could be.
And, you know, and so that was the like, and Khonshu's just hasn't, but then I just don't know, like if that's the case, why would Khonshu be upset in like the first episode whenever Steven takes over. Like if Khonshu can just take control at any moment, then why wouldn't he just do that?
Mm-hmm.
Why would he need to rely on cooperation with the avatars? Because someone pointed out, Lance actually on our Slack pointed out that, you know, in that scene whenever Khonshu is turning back the night sky and he says, I can't do it alone. You know, Lance was saying like that struck him as sort of odd because isn't he a god? Like, shouldn't he be able to do that? But I think again, that feels like an intentional choice. Like he needs the avatars to really function
well
in full capacity right. within the world.
Well, and we kind of know that because of that scene where he makes the wind go crazy and Hero says, don't worry, that's all he can do. Without you, he can't do exactly. other stuff. Yeah, so he's right. not a god. He's not like a living, breathing god like we've known. They need these avatars right. to come to life.
So yeah, I could see a way where they would make that work, where maybe he's like got some hold on Mark, and what he's wanting is, like, I don't know if I said this last time, but I think it should be said, the Jeff Lemire, Greg Smallwood run that I keep referencing, in the end, what you find out in that run is that Khonshu is in fact kind of the bad guy of this particular story, and that what he's trying to get Mark to do, there's this final plea where he's like, look, you've had so much pain, your mind is so fractured, why don't you just kind of surrender, just give your body to me, and I will basically act in your body and you will cease to exist, and with that all of your pain will cease to exist. And I could see something like that, you know, where it's like maybe like that's the end game here for Khonshu. But I just don't know that we've gotten quite enough set up for that sort of a turn, especially given that the runtime for this final episode, I think, is supposed to be the shortest of the series so far and the shortest finale so far of the Marvel Disney Plus shows.
Right, which makes me sad. My final leftover, I was just struck by how much of a failure this was on Mark's father, Mr. Spectre, too.
Oh, wow.
Just because, yeah. I mean, he's clearly trying to be loving and caring to Mark, but I'm just sitting there thinking, like, how can he stand idly by with his wife going up the stairs and after a child like that? Like, you can't do that. Like, and then when they're at the therapy thing where his mom freaks out on him and says, like, you shouldn't be here, it's your fault. Like, okay, someone's got to stand up for the child. Like, that's your child. And then I think they're intentionally trying to show us that because the scene where he's in college and he's leaving or whatever, and he's like, right. I can't, you know, come back in. He's like, that's, you should have done something, Dad. You should have fixed it. Yeah. That's what he says to him. And I was like, yeah, he should have, man. Like, you can't just let somebody abuse a child like that. That's a failure on his dad's part. And that makes me sad.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you said that, because that is true. I mean, it's sad because you see like the birthday party where he's trying, like you said, right. but yeah, that's like, there's, if his father had been kind of willing to stand up for him, he wouldn't have needed to create, you know, potentially, especially with Jake, like someone to stand up for him. Like if that is kind of what that character is. And yeah, I think that scene with him like going to join the army and that kind of being the final straw was really tragic. But again, like a really effective way of showing how like broken and isolated this guy has to feel at that point, which then, you know, kind of goes back to just the interesting element of the whole DID thing, like where there have been a couple lines here where it's like, I noticed this even in episode 4 early on. There's a moment where Mark says to Steven, like, hey, just know, like, you're not alone here. Like, I'm with you if you need anything. And I'd kind of missed that initially, like, because there's so much of the kind of competitive, like, going after Layla and he punches him in the face and that dynamic. But there's a little bit there where Mark is like, it's like an earnest, like, hey, I'm with you. And you have to wonder how much of that is a response to, I mean, like Mark has been forced into this place in his life where he was so alone. Like he was dealing with this grief of having lost his brother And he couldn't share that with his family because he was being blamed for it. So it's like he's been kind of stuck in this spot by himself really his entire life since then. And then now he's got these identities that finally make him feel like he has some level of camaraderie and community. Yeah, it's like, it's so heartbreaking. It's also just such a poignant study of this particular kind of trauma. And we should say, maybe as the final leftover, at least on my part, thanks to all of y'all that have reached out and kind of talked about your reactions to this episode and some of you kind of sharing the way that it maybe interacted with your own story. We really appreciate that. And that adds so much to this experience. And like I said to someone earlier this week, like, man, I mean, that's what good art does, Kyle. You know, it's like it messes with us, like you've said, and it spurs bigger conversations and like bigger reflection. And I think it's just, I just love so much that we can have these conversations and we're talking about a Marvel show. Like, we're talking about a show called Moon Knight about somebody that has a magic suit and, you know, jumps on buildings. And I just think that it's such an impressive feat here from everyone behind this one.
No doubt. Okay, last but not least, this is a fun tradition for us now. We got a chance to talk with the composer from Moon Knight.
Yes. Man, what a nice guy. This was a fun one. This was a treat.
No doubt. So without further ado, here is Hesham Nazi.
All right, everybody. Today, today is an extra special day because we are talking to the composer from Moon Knight. Yes, that guy who gave you... And so we are incredibly honored to have Hesham Nazi join us today. Welcome to Friends from Work.
Yes.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Kyle and all. Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be with you today, Eddie. So
thrilled to have you. So it's perfect.
And we know there's quite the time difference here. So we appreciate you coordinating with us to because you're in Cairo at the moment, correct?
It's a perfect time for me. Yeah. It's 9 p.m. my time in the evening. That's a great time to cool chat and have a cool chat with friends, and you know it's the last few days of the month of Ramadan when everybody in Egypt stays up late in the night.
Oh, so, yeah.
So
night, you're just getting started at night.
Yeah. Right. It's a perfect time to talk music, which it sort of leads me to my next question here, kind of broadly. When you found out that you would be composing Moon Knight, you know, kind of very early on, I'd love to know what your initial thoughts were. Like, did you have kind of sparks of inspiration or influences that kind of gave you a sense of what you wanted Moon Knight to sound like that kind of led you to what we've now been getting in the series?
Oh, yeah, I don't have a short answer for that.
Love long answers. Yeah.
Because when I first learned that I'm going to write music for this fabulous story and this great, great show, and it most intriguing character that I've written music for. Mm-hmm. It's like I had so many thoughts jumping into my head. Well, first to start, what to do first, what not to do. Okay, let me, because usually when I write music for a feature or for a story or for something, I usually start with the silly thoughts first and exclude them and eliminate them. And then, and then by the time when I find an idea that I'm falling in love with or I cannot get rid from or uh-huh. I can get away off or something like that, a very imposing idea, I start to believe that this idea has something to tell me. So when Moon Knight, I had a journey of thoughts first from the first moment I learned that I'm going to write music for Moon Knight, and then up until the moment I clicked send the music suite to Marvel. So yes, it was quite a journey. What a journey of And guess what? It's classic, and it might sound cliche, but it's that's what happened. It was the first idea.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the very first moment, the first day, in the first when I first played it, my hand on my piano, and that's what happened.
Incredible.
Yeah, I stayed for like 2 weeks to make it better, to change it, come up with more elaborate, and no, I just returned back to the first one, and that's the one you heard in the show.
What about that thing? Like, how did you get there mentally? Did they give you a little pitch on the character, and like, or you saw a little clip, and that's what led you to write that theme? Or like, how do you get from nothing to that theme, and that be the first thing that you come up
with? All of the above, all what you told me, all what you said, just said that what had happened. I had, they told me so many things. Well, when you first told me it's a character in Moon Knight, we cannot tell you anything yet up until you sign all the contracts and stuff like that.
Right.
I started the reading because there's so much online to find about Moon Knight.
Background,
the character background, the story of Mark Spector and Steven and Khonshu. And then for me, as an Egyptian, or Khonshu, was easy to find out what is the real Khonshu, which is, by the way, it's Khonshu, is the ancient Egyptian, how it's spelled. It's pretty close to Khonshu. And then I did a lot, what do you call homework? Because it was really enjoyable what I found, what I read about Moon Knight and Mr. Knight. And then we started to dig deep in the process. This is where I traveled to Budapest to meet with the director, Mohamed Dieb, which was the first meeting between him and I. And we've never met before, never worked, which is, it was fantastic. Of course, I knew him too well, very well, from his work here in Egypt, in Egypt, of course, from his films. But it was the first meeting in Budapest, and this was funny. And then he told me a lot more about the character, about the tone of the show, and about his ambitions, about what's he up to. And then I started reading the script. And I stayed there for like a week. And then I got back to Cairo and I started the whole thing. There's a magical story happened just a few days before the Budapest trip.
Well, I want to hear this then. Tell me the magical story.
Yeah,
we love magical stories.
Yeah, it was, you know, I'm this kind of guys who believe in signs and stuff like that. I do, really. And I search for signs sometimes and look for them.
Yeah,
they come when you look for them. They show up. And for reasons doesn't have anything to do with the Moon Knight at all. Mm-hmm. I had to travel from Cairo, had to fly from Cairo to Luxor, which is about an hour flight from Cairo to Luxor, the city of Luxor, and stay there for like 6 or 7 hours, doing nothing much, and then flying back home, which, this has absolutely nothing to do with, with the Moon Knight show. And during those few hours I stayed in Luxor, we had, among a bunch of colleagues and people, we had a tour guide who took us to visit the temple of El Karnak, which is a huge, huge, huge temple. It's very famous. You must have came across a photo or something about El Karnak. It's very famous. In the premises of this temple, there is another temple. I didn't know that at all. This was the temple of Khonshu.
No way.
Standing in there, at the center, at the heart of this second, the Khonshu temple, I found the... I was counting the hours to fly back because I had to go come back to Cairo because I was running out of time. And the guy said, okay, we're now in the temple of Khonshu. I was like, huh?
Wow.
And I thought, is that Khonshu, the god? Yeah, and he was like, this is the god of the moon. And he started saying a lot about Khonshu because Khonshu is an ancient god, has evolved throughout the years. And then I was mesmerized by the coincidence and by the situation. And
then
took us even into a chamber that is not usually open to visitors, which is the chamber of Khonshu himself. And guess what? It was full moon by that time. So
wow.
So yes,
that's wild.
Yeah, this is a really amazing story, and it was amazing. And then when I flew back home, I sent a message to Mohammed, the end director, and told him, "Guess what? I had a little invitation from our guy. We just
over." Wow.
Yeah.
So that has to be in your mind then when you're scoring the scene, for instance, from episode 5, where we see Mark there, you know, within the temple of Khonshu, or before the statue of Khonshu, kind of having his moment with the moonlight coming in. You had to have some flashbacks there, I would think.
Oh, I had them all the time in the back of my mind, and I had that. You know, there is no practical use of this kind of situations. I mean,
sure.
Can I tell you? But it's just, it feels that you're somehow, I don't know how to put it. It's just, it helped me.
You're inspired.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
I have two like nitty gritty music questions. Okay. One, on the Egyptian culture front, like for us Americans, what part of the Egyptian culture was brought into the actual score of this thing? Like, how would you, maybe you can't even define that because maybe you just do it. What part of that culture made it into the music?
I don't know. You know, Egypt is an ancient nation. It's a very old country, and you can call a countless of cultural aspects and call them Egyptians because, you know, it's tens of thousands of years of cultural, what do you call that? Succession of different aspects and different shapes. So for me as an Egyptian, for nowadays, that's the year 2022, I can, I take the liberty and put my hand and take what was used in 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 1,000 years ago, and call it Egyptian because that's what it is. So in music, there are so many musical styles that are still Egyptians. So, and so many musical instruments that have been used in 1,000 years and amazingly enough, still used up until this day, up until today. And which, for instance, is the mizmar and the arhul, the reed type instruments. Very narrow in registers and in octaves. It's just, one of them is just an octave and a half. And then very, very, it's pretty close to the zurna, and pretty close to the bagpipes in essence of the sound and shape of the sound, but it's intonation and the interval between one note and another, and the unwilling ornamentation between the notes when the player plays it, that makes it the feel of Egypt. Instantly takes you there. And the rababa, which is of course an ancient Egyptian instrument, which it's very, it's similar to the sarangi, the Indian sarangi, or something like that, or the, you know, it's a bow and string instrument, only two strings, with a very, very small cup and a bow, a very primitive bow, still played up until today.
Wow.
It's somewhere between the viola and the violin in timbre. Gets the intonation and the nuances and stuff like that, that is pretty much Egyptian.
That was such a better answer than I ever could have hoped. I love
it. Yeah, that's fascinating.
So my other nitty gritty thing is more of a compliment, less of a question. I just need to tell you this. So before this interview, I went back and started from when Mark goes back to the asylum in, you know, towards the back half of episode 4 and rewatched all of episode 5. Oh my goodness. What a magnificent work of art you did, the entire asylum thing. So first of all, I noticed, I love the constant droning thing you have, because as an audience are seeing this, our minds are literally blown, and I feel like you're making me feel crazy, and that's what I love so much, because you then keep this drone going the whole time, and then you bring in the boom, boom,
yeah,
boom, boom, and it sounds almost like a clock, and oh my gosh, the work there is unbelievable, and then you get this one shot of Mark drops the little Moon Knight statue, and our minds are still blown, and you do a tiny little in the background. Oh, dude, that just magnificent work on the back half of 4, and well, on all of it, but especially those two. Holy cow.
Okay, thank you. No, Carl, I'm really happy that you like it, because this whole show has been great and special to me. But 104, especially this harsh flip of everything.
Yes. Oh,
that's everybody's dream, you know. Oh, all right. Okay, let's stick it to the extreme far end all of a sudden. Uh-huh. So it's very exciting, very thrilling, very inviting as well for any composer to act strange. Only then you're excused, because everything is happening is not yet excused. Mm-hmm. Why are you doing this, you know? So, but at the time I tried everything not to follow the unnecessary drives or not to do anything that is unnecessary, or not to do anything that's only that is not contextual, you know. Okay, mm-hmm. in moments like that, when I feel myself too driven by so many ideas, I hold on. And I said, okay. What does the story says? Mm. Say in a way that is clear. In unclear situation, you will be impactful yet interesting at the same time. So,
wow.
And then Robbie, I'll let you get one more question, I promise. But my last question then is, what was the feedback you got from Marvel? Like, you turn it in. I'm just curious, behind the scenes, what did they say when you sent it in the first time?
I believe they like it. I believe.
Apparently.
Yeah, I believe they like it. I've been getting so many kind feedback and so many kind words and words of appreciation and all sweet things that they're, and the amazing people at Marvel, that they're giving me all the support in the world and all the guidance and stuff like that, because the whole process to me was kind of new, so I had to
get back with
them. And so they were fantastic, really. Well,
we spoke to Henry Jackman, who scored the Captain America films, or the second two Captain America films, and he talked about how whenever he kind of came up with some of the more like jarring elements within that first film that he scored, he was kind of nervous to bring some of that to Marvel, and was so encouraged by their response and how much they were, you know, willing to kind of let him explore creatively and maybe push the boundaries of what the genre had been doing. And it sounds like you kind of got a similar response.
Absolutely. I remember the first meeting before I start writing the music with Dave Jordan, and he told me, don't be fearful. Just do whatever you feel like, and don't be fearful, and do not do the music that you would think that we would like. In other words, don't make us the another Avengers. We already have that, so we don't need that. Okay? There's a reason why we want you on board. So it's all about you and the way you write music. So don't try to hide that. Don't try to be someone else. This was priceless to me, because, you know, at first you always want to impress. You always want to put it in the back of the net from the first shot, you know, and then and then the environment was so new to me, and I wanted to, I didn't know how. Do you usually get it complete? Do you usually get the mock-up right? Or can I bring something that is half done? And then it was all a mess inside my head. And then Dave introduced me to Anele, the supervisor, music editor, at that same meeting. And Anele was amazing. I keep talking to tomorrow about how what he did to me with me, and how helpful he was and everything. But in that meeting, he reminded me of, okay, just to make me feel comfortable, he said, it was like, we have listened to your music before, you have written music for real kings and queens, which I did a few months before Moon Knight.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, in this golden parade, the mummy parade, that we were transporting the mummies of the 22 kings and queens from the old museum in Cairo, downtown Cairo, to a new
That's one. Incredible.
That's so fascinating that I didn't know anything about.
You have to lead with that next time.
I will lead with that next time. So yeah. It was quite an experience. They were real kings and queens, Ramesses the Great, and all that. It was amazing. Which in this journey that took about 15 minutes long,
mm-hmm.
with a huge parade that took place in downtown Cairo, was amazing, amazingly done. I wrote the music that was performed live with an orchestra in the new place, receiving the parade and receiving those kings and queens. So I wrote about 50 minutes of music and songs in this journey. So yeah, so somebody says, oh, you have written music for real kings and queens. So take it easy. So it's gonna be, it was instantly make me feel like a friend. And the note of don't be fearful. Do not try to hide who you are. It was instrumental to my thought process, really.
Man, I love hearing that. And that's just, it's great to hear that Marvel is encouraging creators in that way. And we hear that so consistently from folks.
Absolutely. He even said we like to be surprised. And that's the magic of being a composer or being a professional artist. It's you trying to surprise yourself first and try to surprise others. And you're looking for something that is unusual or you're constantly in search of something that makes your day different and special from the previous and the next day. That's it.
Right.
Well, you made my days very different and special. I'll tell you that right now. We can't wait to see what you do in the finale. I know you can't say anything, but then hopefully there's some more Hisham Nazi coming up in my life. I mean, is there anything that you're working on that we can know about?
Oh, no, nowadays I'm enjoying a much needed time off with my family, and my wife and daughter. And yeah, because it was a fantastic ride for concert that way, 8 months maybe or something like that.
Wow.
Oh yeah. So
you've earned it.
Indeed.
Well, thank you so much. This has been an absolute honor, and hopefully we'll talk to you down the road.
Thank you. Thank you, Carl. As I'm happy to be with you and Rob and enjoyed it a lot.
Well, you are welcome back literally anytime. Free pass on the Friends from Work.
Yeah, I will. Sure. Thank you.
So much fun. Add Hisham to the list of a friend from work now. Maybe we can get him back. B, someone I want to hear more stuff from. So I can't wait to see if he gets some more MCU stuff, especially. And C, someone who was just an absolute joy to talk to and who spoke highly of Marvel. So that's kind of fun again. It's just rinse, wash, repeat at this point with people that are impressed with working with Marvel. So thank you guys so much for listening. This is just the beginning of Moon Knight and Doctor Strange Mega Week. Tonight, as we said, we're seeing Doctor Strange 2. So we have a ton of episodes and content coming up regarding both of those things. And we can't wait to dive into it with all of you. As always, please rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And follow us on social media at the FFW Podcast. And we will be announcing our Cinemark gift card and our Moon Knight hoodie giveaways this upcoming week. So stay tuned for those. We love you guys all so much, and we'll see you next time on Friends from Work.
Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
What's standing between you and your first sale on Shopify? Time, expertise, resources? What if you could multiply all three? Product descriptions? Done. Store insights? Delivered. 2 a.m. customer questions? Handled instantly. Entrepreneurs on Shopify are reaching their first sale faster with AI that works with you. Go to shopify.com/firstsale to see how entrepreneurs use AI to grow their businesses faster. That's shopify.com/firstsale.